Hey, welcome to the Beginner Photography Podcast. This week, we are revisiting some of the biggest lessons of the year that we learned from our guests. Hey, I am Raymond Hatfield. I'm a wedding photographer and host of this year's Beginner Photography Podcast. And as the year comes to a close, I always like to look back and reflect on the things that we have learned throughout the year. Now, with 61 episodes this year, it's easy to overlook something that, you know, in the moment you did not realize it, right? Maybe you're in the car, maybe you're at the gym and, you know, you're making a turn or you were changing machines, you know, whatever it was, and you just missed one little bit of information. And at that time, it didn't seem like a big deal, but it's times that we revisit these things, right? Like a good movie. Sometimes you pick up on something that the second time around, you know, you get that you didn't notice on that first go around. So in these episodes, and actually next week's episode, I handpick some of my favorite moments of the year that I know will help you grow your skills as a photographer. Now, the first two clips that we got are all about just getting started, both technically and getting your mindset right. The first clip is actually from my interview with Brian Caparici from episode 239, if you want to go back and listen to it. Brian, what an amazing dude. Brian has been shooting weddings forever. And in fact, his work is actually taught in actual college courses. So, you know, to say that the dude knows something about photography is an understatement. In this clip, he is going to share his three-step process for new photographers to learn photography. In a time where new photographers are coming in right now, especially right after the holidays, lots of people get cameras, you know, for the holidays and whatnot. There's a lot of things that we can be focusing on, and it can be very overwhelming because quickly you realize, oh, this is really more than just pressing a button. Yeah. So for those photographers who are worried, what are some of the things that they should be focusing on right now at this stage to kind of avoid potential overwhelm?
I would say, like, take it a step at a time. I think that's probably the biggest mistake that I see photographers make, especially in those early days. Actually, interestingly enough, anecdotally, I was in a clubhouse room last night just kind of hanging out with, 60 or 70 other photographers. And there was a conversation that there was a newer photographer. She was, you know, I looked at her Instagram. Her work was beautiful on her Instagram. She was still a student, and she was kind of going on about how she had just finished paying for like a styled shoot, to participate in this styled shoot. And like, I was like, I raised my hand and just started asking questions and discussing with her because genuinely I don't quite understand it. I get that like it's a thing, but like my biggest challenge was like, so what are you trying to show off in doing something like this? Because you're in this perfectly styled, expensive setup with zero pressure or timelines or limitations or anything. Like, it doesn't really show off what you can do as a photographer. It just shows that you know how to press the button and what settings to use and that you know how to edit a picture. And that kind of comes back to what we're talking about here, in my opinion. It's really easy to kind of let our ego, and again, I was there, so I'm speaking from experience, I'm not criticizing, to let our egos get ahead of us in the sense of like, oh yeah, I know this stuff, like I'm gonna just start. It's like, you need to walk before you run, you need to crawl before you walk, you know what I'm saying? Like, you need to kind of take it bit by bit. And I think to try and get into like, you know, I hear these conversations now where photographers who are so early in their career are talking about ideal client, and that's not the kind of luxury wedding I want to have, and this and that. And it's just like, guys, like, you get a handful of seasons under your belt just like shooting weddings first. Like, you need to understand, because not only, there's a couple of paths that I see here. Number one, like we talked about, you have to learn the technical. Like, you need to be able to understand your camera, the technical, the settings, exposure. You need to get that stuff like flawlessly off the back of your hand. With that, it needs to be second nature. That's the first part. As soon as you get over that, you're in a good place, right? Next, add the pressure to it, right? So now do that in the pressure cooker. So that's the next thing. And then once you can get over that, so you can show up to a wedding and you can technically get perfection. That is like the next step. Now you're into the milestone. You're into this next stage of your growth as an artist, where now you need to stop looking at things as technical problems and start looking at things that have meaning. So how do you look, you talked about moment. How do you look for moment? How do you find nuance? How do you piece together details? How do you compose in a way that has the impact? Like there's all these things, and those are so far away from the technical capabilities that we have as photographers. That's where you become a good wedding photographer, when you can look at things and go beyond the technical. So that would be like the path that I would recommend a photographer going through. And that's why I'm not a fan of the styled shoot concept, because I don't think that it teaches any of those things. It just teaches that you know how to press the button and get the right settings. But, and yes, you need to know that stuff, but that shouldn't be what you're presenting as your ability as a photographer, because that's not reproducible on a wedding day. So that would be kind of the path that I would recommend, is like, you know, number one, make sure that you get technically confident. Number two, make sure that you can perform in that technically confident way under the pressure of a wedding day. And then number three, forget about all that stuff. As soon as it becomes second nature and it becomes habitual, then you need to just trust your mind and your body and like your muscle memory to do those things. And then now you need to be focusing on the things that actually make an impact in the work that we do, which is nuance and moment and storytelling and cohesion and consistency and all those kinds of things. And then once you figure that out, once you get beyond that, then it's all about, okay, great. So now you can tell a story, you can capture a moment, you can see these things, you can predict when like the laugh is going to be the best, you can predict when this moment's going to happen, you can react, you can see. Then now you need to take the camera and everything away from it and make sure that you can integrate yourself on a wedding day in a way that is relatable, that you can connect with people, that you can create an environment that elicits real emotion. You can make people feel at ease. You can make interactions to orchestrate moments sometimes, or you can make interactions where you actually are invisible in the moment, so moments can happen without your interest. So that's like the next step of growth. And I'm not sure what would come next, but like those are like the few main steps that I would say. It's a journey, right? Like it's a journey. It's a stepping ladder that you need to walk up, and so many photographers try and jump to that last rung, and it's like you got to do the work. You got to put the time in. You got to do the work.
So I want to say to the whole stylized shoot type deal right there, I'm torn on this, because in the same sense, like this is not something that I would do. I would never find myself, especially paying for a stylized shoot. I could see myself helping out other vendors doing some sort of stylized shoot, obviously with them. But we're talking about the sense of like it's a new photographer and they're looking to gain quote-unquote experience, build a portfolio by doing this. And two things that I hear most from new photographers is that, A, they don't have enough time to practice photography, and B, they don't have anybody to practice with. So when it comes to these stylized shoots, like I see where that comes from. I see the desire to go to these things, but you're right. They're missing like such this big step of it's not just the technicals. It's being able to replicate this under pressure in a real world environment. So for those who, you know, are worried about time, for those who are worried about not having the people to photograph, if doing, you know, stylized shoots isn't the way to go, is there anything else that you could recommend maybe to build practice and possibly grow their portfolio as well?
Yeah, for sure. I think this all sits in this foundation of slowing down. I think it, and again, like, believe me, I've been there, so I understand. So I'm not criticizing, but I'm more trying to encourage through experience.
Of course,
this idea that, like, you know, we all want to pick up the camera, we figure out this technical thing, and then we want to start running. But it's like, success in this industry and growth and longevity and sustainability are not going to come overnight. Like, you know, every overnight success is an overnight success 10 years in the making. Like that's it's never an overnight success. And so the pull to want those quick results is so like we can feel it. It's there, but try to pause that feeling and slow yourself down and say it's okay that it takes time to build these things up. It's okay that you don't get this right away. It's okay that you can't pay $300, get a perfect portfolio, and then book these luxury brides the next day. Like, that's not going to happen. That's not a sustainable way to build a business. So my advice would be to get in and almost follow the similar path to what I just talked about with myself, where get in and figure out the technical. Like, you don't necessarily need to have a bride in front of your camera or a groom in front of your camera to figure out the technical. I mean, go out there and just shoot whatever you can around you. Shoot, do self portraits, go out and photograph nature, like do whatever you can, just to, like, you need to be, the camera needs to be an extension of your eyes, of your mind, of your vision. Your hand almost needs to not even, like, it needs to be, again, like muscle memory. So whatever you can do just to, like, put in the hours, put in the time, that's fine. Beyond that, now you, if you want to start understanding the nuances of applying those skills and applying that muscle memory to people, find people to photograph them. Like, that would be, I don't think we need to have this, like, luxury boho bride with this beautiful barn wedding and blah, 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 in order for us to practice that, because that's not when you want to practice. You want to make mistakes when you're photographing your kids, or when you're photographing, like, the neighbor's kids, or when you're out, you know, whatever you're doing to practice photographing people, that's when you want to make mistakes, not when you're paying $500 to be at this perfectly styled shoot. So do that. And then even once you've gotten that, now you need to start second shooting. I am such an advocate for, like, the concept of interning. I think it's so important, and it's so underutilized in our industry. It's almost utilized in a way that, like, hey, I want a second shoot for you so I can build a portfolio. No, the whole point of second shooting is not to build a portfolio. If you can, great. If you can build a relationship with a photographer and do that, wonderful. But the point of it is to learn the ropes, to understand what it's like, to put in your hours, to put in your hours. Who is it that writes about the 10,000 hour rule? In order to get good at something, you got to put in 10,000 hours. That's what we got to do as photographers. If you want to photograph weddings, get out there and photograph weddings, but do it and learn and be humble about it and be hungry for it and be willing to make mistakes and be willing to carry someone else's bags, because you know that they did that 10 years ago. I did that 10 years ago, 15 years ago. Like, so you have to put in the time. And I think that's the best way to do it. Are you going to be able to shoot luxury weddings next year if you go that path? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. But you're going to learn. You're going to get in there and you're going to practice. You're going to know what it's like. You're going to be able to talk with another photographer. You're going to see what you like. You're going to see what you don't like. You're going to have experience practicing with your camera. You're going to have experience engaging with a couple, engaging with family members, understanding the nuances of a wedding day, and you'll be able to go from there. It's a slower path, but it's a path that gives you success in the long term.
I love how easy it is for Brian to just lay everything out in a very easy to understand way. Your camera needs to be an extension of your hands so that it becomes invisible. You know, don't try to leapfrog ahead. It needs to be so, you need to be so used to using your camera, because photography is just, it's a lot more than just pressing a button. And you know that, because if all you had to do was press a button, then every cell phone photo that you take would be an award winner, you know, literally everything. But it's things like engaging with, you know, your subjects, the people in front of your camera. It's things like focusing on light. It's things like paying attention to moment and capturing that. Those are the things that are going to make your images stand out. All right, next up we have Ellie McKinney from episode 240 talking about the revelation that she had at an engagement session that set her on the path to being a better photographer. Now, I want to go back to that, you know, that first engagement shoot. I want to go back to that wedding.
Oh my gosh.
We're talking about our earliest days. We're talking about our mistakes. You know, looking back at those photos, what are some things that when you think about those photos or you see those photos that you think to yourself, oh my gosh, I would totally do, you know, X, Y, or Z differently today? Hey, Raymond here. If you're sometimes baffled by which camera settings to use, then I've got just the thing for you. My free guide, Picture Perfect Camera Settings. It's a fantastic starting point for anybody eager to understand the basics of camera settings in various shooting scenarios. And it's tailored to beginners who want to get out of auto mode, providing clear, easy-to-follow suggestions on where to start with your settings. So whether you're capturing a stunning landscape or a family portrait, Picture Perfect Camera Settings will help you to get off of automatic mode and explore the possibilities your camera offers. Remember, mastering photography settings is a journey, and this guide is your first step and the perfect resource to guide you towards finding the right settings for your style. So grab your copy today at perfectcamerasettings.com and start your journey to better photos.
Oh, it's just the basics. And these are the first things that I notice in anybody's photography. And honestly, I'm not a rules-driven person. So the rules of photography, I love breaking them, trying to see how I can make something even better if I just were to keep them in mind, but still bend the rules a little bit, if that makes sense. And so whenever we're thinking about photography, the most simple thing that you can do to make a photo more aesthetically pleasing, for the most part, is having a straight horizon line. So if a sunset is totally tilted and it goes from corner to corner on a photograph, if you guys can picture this, this was the biggest go-to mistake that I mean, almost every image, I'm like, do I stand crooked? Like, what really happened?
Do I stand crooked?
This many things to go wrong. And things like that, you know, I even posted, just to be vulnerable, a picture the other day where a pole was behind the bride. And so it's like coming out of the back of her head in the image. And like, that's a huge no-no. I did it because the bride said that was her favorite, one of her favorite moments. And so I really wanted to showcase that and said, screw the rules. If this is something my bride loved, I want to be able to celebrate her in this moment. So but when every picture has something that's almost totally wrong in those first few moments of grabbing a camera and just going for it, that's when you got to just cringe a little.
Right, of course. And we all have those moments for sure.
Yes.
Yeah. I get it. Now, is there any way that you can kind of put yourself back in that headspace of shooting? Was there anything maybe in the moment that, you know, obviously that with the, you know, crooked horizons and whatnot, that's something that we really realize after the fact. And sometimes I'll be shooting and I'll think to myself, we're level here. And then I get it in the computer and I'm like, we are not. You know, it's always about 7 or 8 degrees off for some reason. But in that moment while you were shooting, was there anything that maybe wasn't working, or did you have any sort of aha moment at some point where photography just started to click for you?
Yes, it was during the engagement session and I couldn't get the lighting right. Everything was overexposed. I didn't know the term overexposed in the moment, but I just knew it did not look right. And and skin tones, it was a hot mess. And so I decided to put the camera in manual and try to mess with things. I didn't know what I was doing. I ended up figuring it out. I think I just got lucky from switching a dial. I'm not really sure like what happened in the moment for me, but it was the realization that I can manipulate light and be in charge of what this looks like and how I capture environments. And that for me was one of the most exciting moments to say, oh, I can be in control. I can make this situation better purposefully and intentionally. And of course I didn't know how, but it just, as soon as I got home, I started Googling. I mean, I was on, and this is whenever, you know, YouTube and Google, you could find like a few things. There was not as much information out there, but there were definitely answers that I was able to use and move forward knowing that I could get better. And so that sparked like this competitive drive within me where it just made me realize there's so much more I need to learn. I'm going to do just that.
Mm-hmm. Was Google, would you say, is that your main source of education?
Absolutely. And trial and error.
Yeah, of course. I mean, there's always going to be that trial and error, you know?
Yes.
And then it really depends on the person, whether or not you're going to, I guess, learn from some sort of outside source and try to, I don't know, leapfrog that trial and error, if that's the right term there. But, you know, if anybody spends any time on your Instagram, they're going to see comments on your photos that describe you as brave, as strong, as a fearless woman who takes charge, you know. And then we read some of your your own posts where you are open and you talk about struggles that you have in, obviously, you know, our lives and our relationships and, you know, raising a young son. And, you know, when it comes to what's the question that I'm trying to ask here? How do you, like, where is that balance, right? Because on one side, you are what other people are looking up to, you know? But at the same time, what you're saying is that, like, I'm still a human. Like, I'm here. You know, where, this is a terrible question. I apologize for this. I just realized that this sounds like a really bad question. But does this make sense? Where's that balance for you? Like, are you trying to, wow, this is like the worst question I've ever asked. You're not trying to put off, obviously, like something that you're not. You're trying to be authentic to who you are. Okay, here's the question that I'm asking, right?
Love it.
With you being open and vulnerable, why do you think that resonates so well with people who use terms like, you know, strong, fearless, brave, those types of things? Does that make sense?
It totally does. Nobody's ever asked me this, so I can feel like my heart racing.
Nobody's ever asked you a 15-minute long question?
Not even that. It's there's been a lot of comments around my posts, especially whenever it has to do with worldly views, but nobody who's ever specifically asked me. And I forgot people say that in comments. So thanks for that reminder, because I totally forgot. You know, the balance in being able to know how much to say and what not to say, there is a super...
That's what I was trying to say the whole time. So, yes.
I totally get it. I totally get it. I'm with you. And that's the thing, is I push boundaries. I do. I talk about Black Lives Matter. I talk about LGBTQ+. I talk about raising a son and what that could look like, what I want it to look like. There are people who disagree with me, and I've had to be okay with that, because one of the things that I focus on is core values within my business. And so I saw people, I probably can't even call them out, so let me not like word vomit that. I saw big companies not saying anything about anything and just going about their normal sales and their normal marketing themes and their normal. And I'm like, our United States is not in a great place, guys. Don't know where you're at, like what life you're living. But there were two businesses that I can think of off the top of my head. And I follow a lot of people on Instagram, but there were two that were making a difference. And I decided right then and there that even if I make a mistake, even if I say something wrong, even if people get upset or I have unfollowing from this, I'm going to be more upset with myself for not being the person that I've always been if I don't say a thing. And so for me in high school, I was signing petitions because I'm like, why can't these people be together? If I'm allowed to hold hands with my boyfriend, like why the heck can't they? And so I get like the PDA thing, and you know, my dad was a school psychologist. The whole thing was very interesting, but it's like, I've never been a person to shut up in the face of fearing what other people think. But owning your own business gives you a whole other type of fear, because you're like, what if nothing works out? And so I had that in the back of my mind. But after talking to my go-to friends, I've got like three of them, they all said, you've never not said something. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter if you're in front of somebody's face, if you're like the person that I am is always saying something. And I want it to be in a way that's as welcoming as possible. So I was very careful with my words. And I did have clients who disagreed with me. And I forgot about this. So I sent out an email to the clients that I had saying, hey, here's the direction I'm going to take. I need you to know this. If there's anything that you disagree with or need to talk about before I do, please let me know. The people who disagreed didn't say a thing. They're like, Ellie's just going to do her thing. Like we kind of already know this about her. But it gave me a chance to have the confidence to go into it saying, I want a better future for everyone. And if I don't say something now, I'm not going to live the life that I wanted to lead.
There are two ways to bring home more money with your photography business. You either get more clients or you spend less of the money that you make. CloudSpot Studio helps you keep more of what you earn. With the lowest payment processing fees in the industry, the average photographer will save $300 annually. And that's just more money to invest in essential gear like a new flash or a sweet camera bag. You know, one that is perfect for storing all of the wedding day snacks that you can pack. But it's not just about savings. CloudSpot Studio is designed to streamline your workflow. Easily organize shoots, send contracts, questionnaires, invoices, and you're really going to enjoy the hassle-free payments. So sign up for a free CloudSpot account at deliverphotos.com. And as a bonus, you're going to get access to my exclusive wedding and portrait contracts and questionnaires at no additional cost. Why let fees chip away at your profits? Empower your photo journey with CloudSpot and watch your business soar. What would you do if, you know, I guess what's the worst case scenario for you there?
Maybe a cancellation, saying I'm not the photographer for them. And I was just going to refund in that scenario and help them find another photographer. It's not worth any amount of money to me.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you didn't see that happen. You saw
the
opposite happen. You saw people go in even deeper into who you are and invest in you.
And I started booking way more. My business grew, and that was not even the purpose. I was shaking over the things I was crying. I told you I was emotional. I'm crying at home, trying to tell my husband, there's got to be more to life than me just being a photographer. Believe me, those conversations were just they were intense.
Sure.
And it just led to being a better business for me because I was honest. Nobody ever has to wonder where I stand. I support every single couple in the best way that I know how. And how can you combat with that, you know?
If somebody right now is listening and they're thinking I want to be more open about who I am. I want to share more of my views and I want the world to be a better place, but they are worried about backlash or what have you. What advice would you give to them?
You will absolutely have backlash. It will be there. If what you're saying does not negatively impact anybody else, then you're saying the right things and you should be pushing for it. And you will find your people. Your people will come to you again with this thing I really hope certain people hire me because I would just love to be around people who are open to people loving people. And that's what I want to drive. And you can't just put out this feeling in the universe for those people to come to you. You've got to make it happen. So speaking to that and being very sincere about, you know, whatever you're passionate about, you know, and if it, my biggest thing is that if it does not negatively impact anybody else, it's worth fighting for.
Vulnerability is really something that I personally struggle with, and hearing Ellie's conviction to just do the right thing and using her camera to make that change was super powerful, really powerful for me. And I feel actually that this is a perfect segue into our next two clips here because they speak to learning to find your photographic voice and using your newfound ability to control your camera and use it to tell a powerful story. So first up, we have Dana Goldstein from episode 249. She is a photojournalist turned editorial photographer turned fine art photographer who delivers a tall glass of truth for what it takes to really make it in the industry.
At the beginning of the 2010s, I quit all of my commercial work. And I began to create my own series and I became a full-time artist.
Yeah. Okay. So then before we move on to your, before we move into the 2010s right there, let me ask, because I'm sure that there are some people listening right now who are looking to get into editorial photography.
Yes.
So I would say if you were to look back at some of your earliest editorial photos, if you can think of one in your head, is there anything that stands out as maybe an amateur mistake or something that, you know, is an overarching theme of your photos that you quickly learn to get rid of for better editorial images?
I think you have to go in really humble. Like, you can't, I mean, people have this kind of TV character idea of a photographer, you know, you come in and you're like, oh, put that there, do that all. That, and it's really not the way it is, because you have to come in and you have to be, I think it's important to be humble and professional. And when you're working with editorial, you have very little time. So you have to be quick on your feet, quick thinking, and quick working, because you're photographing people usually that are important people, or else why are you photographing them? You know what? I mean, they're going to be in a magazine. They did something. They're high profile people. So they don't have much time. And, you know, you just have to be, quick and show them that you respect their time, that, you know, it's, that you're a professional and that you know what you're doing. Yeah. I mean,
I love that.
Yeah. With editorial, I'm trying to think of a mistake, because you keep on asking me about mistakes.
No, you know what? It's one of those things. So here's one thing that I've heard oftentimes from listeners of the podcast, is that when it comes to interviews, I suppose oftentimes I will interview people, photographers like yourself, who have quite a long career, and the photographers who are listening are still in those early days. You know, they've been shooting between 0 and 24 months. Maybe they still have their first DSLR that they got at Costco or whatever, and they see photographers like yourself and think, I want to get there. How do I get there? You know, right. So when it's time to talk to you,
I have an answer for you.
Okay, let's hear it.
When I was at the very beginning of my career, I would whine, oh, I just want to do this. I just want to do this. And I had a friend, and he just looked me in the eye and he said, just do it. Just go out and do it. Yes. That's all. That's all it takes. And you know what? That's all it takes. Yeah. It's like, I mean, the thing is, not everyone's going to have the talent for this, right? Like, I want to be a singer, but I'm a horrible singer. And if somebody said, just go do it, I would do it, and I would break some windows, and it would not be a good scene. But at least I tried it, and I gave it a shot. You know, we only live once. Do it. Just do it. Do it. Now, if you really want to do it, and you feel like you want to make it a career, I think that you should make sure that you are good at it. You know, that you have something that even if it's an early talent, that's something that you can develop. That you have a good eye, because without that good eye, I don't think it's even worth going forward, you know, no matter how many voice lessons that I have, I couldn't do it, because I don't have the natural talent. And you know, it's not something that everyone can do. It's like now that there are digital cameras, and something I noticed in the early 2000s, that there were digital cameras coming in, and people just felt like they could do it. Even art directors, the ones that I was working with, thought, oh, I can do it. You know, like, I have this camera, I can do it now. And it's just not the case.
Yeah.
Just because you have the equipment doesn't mean that you have the eye, and you need the eye to be able to become good, be really good at what you do.
I appreciate you being open and candid there and being honest, you know, because we can all attest to that. We all know somebody who bought the most expensive camera hoping that it was going to take the best photo. And, you know, we just know that it doesn't work that way. And I love that, you know, one thing that I hear from you is that there has to be tenacity to move forward. You have to be okay with making those mistakes.
Yes.
But then, you know, you shared that part right there, which I think is missing from a lot of interviews, which is, you still have to have an eye. Like, you still have to have something there within you to be able to cultivate. And that's a real thing. So again, thank you for being open about that.
And then it's also too, you have to have that eye, and then you have to learn about light and understand light. Like, for instance, if I were to organize a weekend photography course or something, I would just take somebody to the same place the whole day and just like take one object and look at that object. And, you know, we can do it at the studio with a strobe, but you could also do it outside with the sun and see how that particular object changes with the light. Mm-hmm. You have to understand light. You have to see light and feel light and be open to that, to observing, just observing, how light affects and changes everything.
Right, of course. Yeah, that's a major aspect of photography that, again, gets lost in the hoping that the camera will just make everything magical, and we know that it doesn't. So again, thank you for that.
Mm-hmm.
I want to move on now that we're done with the 2010s. We are, here you are, here's Dina Goldstein. You are ready to make your mark on the world. And this is when you introduce your series, Fallen Princesses. Is that correct?
Yes. So this happened just after the digital revolution. So again, I felt that people were kind of making light of the art of photography, the craft of photography, because making images now became so much easier for people mm-hmm. who didn't understand how to use a camera before. Because before digital, you had to understand your shutter speeds and your apertures and light, right? And so in the middle of all that, I thought, you know what, if I'm going to create images, I better create images that nobody else can make.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so this led you to, okay, so I've heard you on many podcasts before. I have, you know, read up on this Fallen Princesses, your collection here. And I know that it started after you found out that your mom was diagnosed with breast cancer.
Yes.
And seeing kind of the wonder in your daughter's eye, right? Can you expand a little bit on that?
Yes. So I'm trying to give you a sense of the time within the photography world, like what was going on when I'm describing this digital revolution and me wanting to make pictures and that were different and that nobody else could make. At the same time, my daughter was in play school, and my mother was diagnosed with breast cancer. And the two events kind of collided. And I started to think, because when my daughter came back from school, from daycare, she was suddenly obsessed with Disney princesses. And I thought, where is this from? I mean, it's not coming from our home. So it's obviously something that she's being exposed to at daycare. It's the only other place she's at. And so my mother's illness and then my daughter's interest made me think about things in regards to how pop culture idealizes gender roles and the way that girls are depicted within these Disney books and films. And I just felt like that it was really outdated, and I didn't want my daughter to be enthralled with this at all. So that's what got me thinking. And I started putting the princesses in real life situations, with real life challenges, or I try to do that to discuss important issues.
So obviously many people are listening right now. Maybe they're not in front of a computer. Could you describe a few of the images for me?
Sure. The very first image that I photographed was Rapunzel, and that was directly inspired by my mother's illness. And here we have Rapunzel sitting on a bed in a hospital room attached to chemo medication. And she's got her wig that's braided, very, very long braid, sitting beside her. Mm-hmm. And she's looking down. She's, it's just a very kind of serene look on her face, I guess. And so that's one of them. And that's like the first one that I photographed. I later went on to portray Cinderella at a pub, kind of sitting.
After a long day.
Yeah, it's supposed to be kind of like a hidden away bar that nobody would see her at. And she's kind of sitting there with a drink. And of course, she's sad. And I have a whole backstory to why she's sad. And then you've got all these kind of pub goers kind of looking at her, trying to figure out what she's doing there. At home in domestic hell.
Yeah.
With a lazy prince.
I'm of course going to put links in the show notes to where, you know, listeners can find more of your images. But I think that you painted a real good picture there, which is like, well, what happens, you know, after they grow up? Like, what happens when they enter the real world? You know, what happens when, you know, the person who we identified as a child now has to face the things that I have to deal with as an adult? Remember, our cameras are simply tools. Tools to document, tools to create, tools to tell a story. And guess what? You're the author. Use your camera to tell the story that is important to you. Okay, next up, this is from an interview 244 with Scott Strazanti. And I got to tell you, this one was a massive episode. Scott is a master of long-term projects. Now, to give you some context about what you're about to hear, Scott shot a long-term photo project called Common Ground. This is where it just started with him following an older couple, Harlow and Jean, who lived on their 100-year-old family farm. And then as he continued to, you know, follow them over a period of time, they sold their farm to a company who then built a subdivision on that land. And then Scott followed a family actually living in that subdivision that was built on the original farmland. Really interesting stuff. So here he talks about what it takes to capture such a strong, powerful photo essay.
Thematically, when I do a photo essay, there always has to be one element that is the same. So like if you're gonna do a portrait series, the background, either the background should be exactly the same, or you shoot it with the same lens and exposure and f-stop and shutter speed. You know, there's gotta be something thematically holding it together, and then there has to be a difference to it. Like for me, I did a photo essay on Liberty tax waivers. I don't know if they have those.
I saw this.
You know? Right, yes. And so basically, the cool thing was, I don't know where these people get their outfits, but they're all kind of different. They're not the same. And so like, you know, this is a Statue of Liberty, and I did it in 2010 in Chicago. And, you know, one person was, you know, Statue of Liberty, anyways, it's hard to describe a photograph in words, but the thing was, I had like 15 of them. They were the same, but each of them were different, and some of them were wildly different. And so it's just kind of, you know, for me, that interests me, is like variations on a theme, and repetition is, you know, it's kind of the same thing in a photograph, where if you photograph one person, it's mildly interesting. If you photograph identical twins, somehow that's amazing. Wow, look at those identical twins. That's amazing. But if you just photograph one of those twins, it's a person, you know? And so like repetition is something that I always look for in photography, and I think is really fascinating. and is really a good way to make a compelling image is, you know, if you can have one of something, two is better, you know? So it's like, there's so many little tricks of the trade that you learn after a while and just kind of, you know, I've been doing this for so long that I walk into a room for a photo assignment and I'm like, okay, where's the good photograph going to be? And I can go over here, you know, and over here, I know this is going to work and this is going to work. And if I use this lens, that's going to work. But then the way to elevate to a great photo is some sort of serendipity, something, a moment happens, or the light is especially great, or there's a great moment and great light, you know? And so, you know, it's definitely, you know, always kind of a puzzle piece. You know, I can always go make a good photograph, but it's going to take something that happens out of my control to elevate it to a great photograph. And, if I make one great photograph a year, I'm pleased, you know? And so that's well, kind of my goal.
Well, it seems by the list of your accomplishments, you make more than just one great photograph a year, which, you know, I'm very thankful for. But going back to long-term projects, one of the questions that I had while going through the book and hearing you talk right there, you know, obviously you showed up your assignment to photograph Harlow and Jean. It ended on a day that their house was torn down. But when you went back to Cinnamon Court to photograph, you know, the new lives that were living here on the suburbs, or in this new subdivision, when do you know that it's over? Like, when do you know that you captured the story? When do you know that you have enough?
I think you get to a point where you know it's like 95% complete, you know, and you kind of, you look at it and you're like, okay, this tells a story. This, you know, you're always looking for some sort of arc, you know, a beginning, a middle, and an end. This great photographer, Carrie Renee Hall, once explained it to me. She said, you know, when you do a photo story, you basically want this. You want a cat climbs up a tree, someone shakes the tree, and the cat gets out of the tree. You know, and I don't know, like, why that resonated with me, but it just seemed like that was, like, the three acts of, you know, you want, you know, something happening, a tension, and then a release of that tension. And, you know, for me, for Common Ground, you know, it did get to a point where I'm like, okay, this, you know, this is done. And I think it was 14 years. It was 2008, 2009. That's when it kind of was 95% done. But since then, I've continued to photograph. I've gone back and visited them many times and have made many more diptychs. And unfortunately, Ed and Amanda have now divorced. And so Amanda's living in the house with the triplets. And I think maybe Ben might be living there now. I haven't photographed there in a year or so. But Amanda told me that when the triplets graduate high school, which will be, I think, a year from June, she's going to move out of the house. So I'm going to go back and photograph them getting ready to move out of the house and then moving out of the house on the final day. And then it'll be done. It'll be 100% done. Unless, like, a circus family moves into that house, and, you know, or something. But, or, you know, but the thing is that, like, that'll be the hard ending for me, because then it'll, you know, and then I'll have so many pairings of the Grabenhofer family moving, leaving the house, with the Cagwins leaving their house. And then I'm not sure what I'm going to do with these photographs. You know, I'll put them on social media. I don't really have an interest in doing another book on it. But we'll see, you know, I'll cross that bridge when I get to it. But yeah, it is a good question. Like, sometimes you don't know. And, you know, a lot of times when a story ends is because the newspaper publishes it and you kind of stop. And that's one thing with the Cagwin story, because it was published in the Herald News. It was published in the Chicago Tribune. It was in Mother Jones Magazine, you know. And so I was always finding new outlets. But most stories I do, it publishes in my newspaper, and then I'm finished with it. And one of the things about being a photojournalist, especially when you do photo stories, that is very difficult, is that you come into someone's life and they trust you to photograph them, and you spend, you know, a week or a month or 8 years photographing them, and then the story's over, and then that's it, you know. And then, like, what do you do? Do you never see them again? Do you, you know, you visit them, you know, and when you have 5, 10, 20 stories like this, you can't continually stay in their lives. Because I've been invited to so many birthday parties and things like that, families I've photographed, and I feel horrible saying, well, I can't, I'm busy. You know, when, you know, they've given so much to me, and I feel like, oh God, you know, there's this kind of separation anxiety to it, because it's a very intimate process to, you know, for someone to be photographed and to kind of trust someone and, you know, be in their home and things like that. And, you know, I've had a couple like really difficult things. I think the most difficult one I ever dealt with was I photographed a young family, in suburban Chicago. It was a woman and a man. They were married. They had 4 young kids, all under the age of 6. And the dad was out jogging one day, and he got hit by a car and was killed. And so this happened like maybe 3 or 4 months before I met the family. And then the community had gotten together to have a big fundraiser for the family. So I was sent down to photograph this family and the fundraiser. So I ended up photographing the family for maybe 3 or 4 hours. And just like the Caguin story, I knew there was more there. And so I asked them, and then I asked my editors, well, can I continue to photograph this family until the 1-year anniversary of the husband's death? And everyone agreed. And so I then went and I started photographing this family. And they were too young. There was a boy who was 6, I think. The girl was 5. I'm forgetting some of the names, which is so horrible. The girl who was 5, and then there were 2 younger girls who were 3 and 2. And so when I first arrived, the 2 young girls, they would come and punch me, and they would kick me, and they were like really angry at me. And, you know, and then maybe the 3rd or 4th visit, they just started hugging me, and they wouldn't let go, and they just like were so attached to me.
Wait, hold on. Were they kicking you because they felt like you were intruding in their lives?
I don't know. Like I imagine there was like somehow they connected me with their dad, and their dad left, and their dad died, and maybe somehow I was some male proxy for that anger or whatever. I don't know. I'm just making that up. Okay. But then once I spent more time with them, then they became really attached to me. And so when it got to be near that 1-year anniversary of, you know, when I knew the story would be over, I started thinking, oh, I'm going to leave them. Like, I'm going to be spending all this time with them. They got attached to me, and now I'm leaving them. You know, am I reinforcing to these little girls that men leave, you know, that you fall in love or you get attached to some man and then they're going to leave, you know? And so, like, I'm making this all up in my head, and I know part of it might be true, part of it might not be true, but it's just like, it's, you know, for me, it just
weighs heavy on you.
Yeah, it's really a weight. And but then, you know, so I lost touch with the family. And then, like, you know, on Facebook, you have those Facebook messages that you don't see. They're like hidden messages because you're not a Facebook friend. And sometimes for 8 months later, you like see all these messages, you know,
like,
and,
dang it.
Yeah. Right. And so I went on there at one point, like maybe 2 or 3 years after, and like message from a woman, a friend of the mom, and saying that she'd had cancer, and, you know, and like, so, and then I tried to reach out to someone, and I don't know what happened. I'm like, so did the mom die? And, you know, and like, I couldn't, like, the phone number I had didn't work, and I still don't know what happened. And it's just like, oh, it just tears me up. And so, you know, it's in photojournalism that, you know, you don't really think about, just kind of those connections that you make, and then you're gone, you know. It's just, you know, I don't know. It's not like I don't think I need therapy for it, because I talk about it a lot, but, you know, it's definitely something that, you know, you don't think of for journalists. You know, there's a lot of, you know, kind of PTSD from photographing wars and fires and things like that, but it's kind of that kind of separation you get from people that you spend a lot of time photographing.
I think we get the idea, you know, that part of being a photojournalist, first of all, I'm sure that you weren't taught this, you know, when you first started shooting, that like, hey, this is going to be a heavy thing at times.
Right.
But also, to me, what it sounds like is, to be able to do this effectively, you really have to have a lot of empathy to be able to tell somebody's story. And I don't think that is taught enough, because I don't think that you can teach that. Right. Very often it seems like whenever you look at either street photography or, you know, documentary photography, it's very much like, here's the technicals of how you do it and here's what you look for. But I don't think I've ever heard of anybody share that side of the story before. And wow, I mean, just myself hearing that, I mean, I feel heavy for that. I can't imagine, you know, what it is that you have to go through. So, you know, thank you for sharing that. That's a lot.
You're welcome. Because there's two types of photography. There's taking photographs and making photographs, you know. And when I do street photography, I'm taking photographs. I'm just walking down the street and I'm taking things. But when, you know, I do a long-term photo story or, you know, someone, you know, like you're making photographs, it's a collaborative effort and you're not taking something, you're part of the process, not the whole process. And so, you know, it's definitely, you know, something where, you know, I'm aware of that. And it's something that, you know, that's why I think at times I love shooting sports, because I could just, here's a roster, here's the names and numbers. I just sit there and I just photograph sports, you know, I don't have to, you know, put myself out there. Because you know, when you do a long-term story, it's a two-way street. You have to share your life for someone to share it back. And, you know, if you're someone who does a long-term story, my recommendations, and this is what I do all the time, is say I know I'm going to photograph someone multiple times. When I come in their house, I will sit on the floor when I talk to them. I'll sit on the floor because I want them to know they're above me. I want them to know that I'm at their service, that I'm not someone who's coming in to stand above them and take their photograph. I want to, like, both, you know, figuratively and literally be below them. And so it's something where that's kind of the place I put myself, and then I share my life with them. And, you know, you would think with, like, the Cagwins or the Grevenhoffers, the photos I make, they're real moments. But throughout that process, there's a conversation going on where, you know, the Gene and Harlow situation, they both were hard of hearing. So Harlow would be like yelling something and Gene would be like, what? And I'd be like, oh, this is what he said. And then Gene would yell back. And I'd be like, oh, Harlow, she's at this, you know? And so, you know, it became this, you'd be this intermediary, but at the same time, you're taking photographs and, you know, and so there is no such thing as fly on the wall. Like, I'm changing reality just by being there. And so you have to kind of realize, well, what photos am I making that I change reality so much that they're no longer reality? And which one is like, well, I'm there and this represents a reality that probably would have happened if I wasn't here, you know? And so, you know, I can go round and round about the ethics of photojournalism and every photo's a lie type of thing, you know? But at some point, if you're going to do that, you just have to quit because, you know, as a photographer, unless you're, you know, in a duck blind and no one knows you're photographing them, which is what street photography is kind of at times, you know, you're not really photographing reality.
It can really be so easy to think of photography as its own thing, right? You know, we buy things for our cameras. We take our cameras places with us with the intention of, you know, photography. We go on photography trips. We want to shoot all these interesting things where it's like photography is this is its own entity. But photography is innately human. And when we're photographing humans, it's really hard not to be aware of the impact that we are making on somebody's life, however small it may be. As a wedding photographer, you know, I'm really a part of somebody's life for a day, right? Recently, I had found out that one of my first weddings that I had shot, the groom just passed away. And I can say, you know, oh, well, I was only a part of his life one day, almost a decade ago. But it's really a two-way street, and he was also a part of my life for a day. But hearing of his passing made it acutely aware to me just the power of photography. And it can be incredibly important, right? Very powerful. But at the same time, from a human connection standpoint, it can also be somewhat trivial. I would love to hear your biggest takeaway from this episode in the Beginner Photography Podcast community on Facebook. If you're not there already, you can easily join the safest place on the internet for new photographers to share photos and ask questions just by searching Facebook for the group, or you can just click the link on our homepage at beginnerphotographypodcast.com. Again, I would really love to know, is there something in this episode that you found stood out to you that you're going to take away and implement into your photography to make you a better photographer? All right, that is it for this week. Until next week, keep shooting, stay safe.
Thank you for listening to the Beginner Photography Podcast. If you enjoy the show, consider leaving a review in iTunes. Keep shooting, and we'll see you next week.